What would it take to rise from the humble beginnings behind the Iron Curtain to becoming a global COO of one of the largest financial firms in the world? For many, it seems impossible, but for our guest today, that's exactly what she was able to accomplish by embracing change, staying adaptable, and not allowing fear to overtake her. Welcome to the Learn It All podcast, the show for today's leaders who realize the importance of continuous learning, because great leaders aren't born or made, they're constantly in the making. I'm Damon Lemby, a two-time best-selling author and CEO of Learn It, a live learning platform that has upskilled over 2 million people over the past three decades. I'm thrilled to introduce our guest today. Her name is Annie Filipova. What you'll learn in this episode, we talk about how Annie rose from a small town in Bulgaria to become the CEO of Citibank Asia, managing over 10,000 employees. In 2021, she made a bold career shift by starting Change Advisories, where she now works as a coach and consultant and speaker to help other individuals pivot in their career. We talk about the key leadership traits that help her adapt and thrive across different roles, different cultures, and different departments throughout her career, why embracing change is essential for leaders, and how to leverage it as a catalyst for growth. Annie talks about how great leaders turn fear and uncertainty into motivation and progress. Annie also shares tips for maintaining a growth mindset in a high-pressure environment. So please stay tuned for this amazing conversation with Annie. Let's jump right in. Let's start off with your childhood. You were born in Bulgaria, a socialist country, and you made an unbelievable rise to becoming COO in Asia for Citibank. Let's just share with our audience your story, please.
When I say I was born behind the Iron Curtain, everybody think that we were very unhappy and it was tough for us. And, you know, all the bleak picture, especially the West, people from the West who've never been to that part of the world. So, and for me, it was not like this, because when you don't know what you don't know and when you don't know what you miss, what you have is amazing. So I had an amazing childhood. I only remember good things. In Bulgaria, mothers and fathers used to work. So for me, women not working is very alien. My parents worked in socialist Bulgaria. Everybody had to work because there was not enough, there was no other way. And we were basically raised up by our grannies because there were no other help. People were relatively poor. We never had a car ever. I had my first car when I was 26, and this is when I learned to drive. But my parents, they never had a car, and we used to live first in a house and then in a concrete building, concrete apartment building, which is very typical for the socialist kind of times. If you go to all the Eastern European countries, you see these suburbs, which are so similar, of these concrete buildings, which were built very quickly because as the socialists really ruined agriculture, everybody was coming to the capital to find work, so they had to build these houses quickly. So, as I said, I was raised by my grandmother, because my parents were working not even in the town we used to live. And only when I was 6 years old, we all got together in the capital of Sofia, Bulgaria. And I was, since very early age, we would go to school walking by ourselves. And I had my key on a ring around my neck. So I would go home. Nobody would wait for me or, you know, sign somewhere to pick me from
school.
Just go. Yeah, exactly. There is nothing organized. There is no school bus. There is nothing. You just walk. And on the way, you walk with your friends. And sometimes you stop by and have lunch with your friends. And then you go home.
Was it safe?
I would do all... Oh, yeah, yeah. It was very safe because we didn't know anything, because there was a lot of propaganda and nothing was said. So I guess there was some kind of, there were problems, but I don't remember. We would walk everywhere at any point of time, at any time of the day, the night, etc. It was very safe, absolutely safe. I mean, I think it is not safe now as compared to before. But that was really my childhood. All the summers I would spend with my grandmother, which is in the south of Bulgaria, and I would have my friends, and we would be out of the house the whole day. So it was really nice. It was. I look back and I only see joy and love and my family was really great one, is a great one, very supportive. I have a sister who still lives in Bulgaria. So that was my upbringing. I really liked to read because there was not a lot of other entertainment, especially when I would go to my grandmother's house in the summer. And she had a bookcase which was a whole wall. So I started reading all type of literature, even outside of my age group. So I was reading everything. All the books that I was supposed to read when I was in 11th grade or, you know, when I'm 16, 17, I started reading it when I was 11, 10, 11, 12. And I liked very much to read about, I always had an interest about what is the world outside of Bulgaria. And I always was dreaming to travel. That was my dream since very, very early age. I just wanted to go out of the country, see how other people live, see other countries. And, you know, I was reading about Singapore and Morocco and Calcutta, and all these names sounded very, very interesting and out of this world. So that's the background, setting the scene. This is how I grew up. And I was coming from a very working class or middle class family. So we were just salary to salary, nothing special. I didn't have any connections, no. I finished university in Bulgaria, no Ivy League, no MBAs, no internship, no connections, nothing. Nothing.
So Annie, you dreamed of this travel. What was the first country you were able to travel to when you left Bulgaria? And what was it like? Was it what you expected? What was it?
Okay. So the first country I went to was Greece.
Okay.
And this was the first.
Where you are now.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So the first flight I took, I was 24 years old, and it was the long flight of 45 minutes from Sofia to Thessaloniki, and it was one of these propellers planes, and I was so scared. I was sure I'm going to die, and the weather was awful. It was all clouds, and it was awful. And then that was my first visit to another country, Greece. I was so excited. I was working for a Greek bank at that time. It was the first international bank in Bulgaria. So you can imagine that's where I'm going to be because I want to travel. So obviously. So that was the first. And then it was exciting. Very, very exciting. I bought a lot of presents. And then I moved to work to another bank, which was Central and Eastern European Bank, Raiffeisen Bank. It is Austrian bank. And with them, I traveled in Europe and Eastern Europe. So this is how everything started.
And when you were finishing up college, to take it back a second, you said you had no connections. You were just kind of on your own. So how did you, well, let's start with, did you always want to get into banking because you love numbers for some reason? So what led you down that path?
Well, I would say chance, because my idea after I finished school, I was studying banking and finance, because the banking era was coming to Bulgaria, and there were many banks and they were opening and they were paying good salaries. It was really great to work for a bank. So I said, okay, this is what I'm going to study. And I studied 5 years. And when I finished, I said, okay, I really not interested in banks. I just want to work in an international organization. And I applied in all the international organizations in Bulgaria. And it was, I graduated in 1992, and communism, socialism was abolished in 1988. So during my time of study, when I was in university, Bulgaria started opening to the world, and then many companies coming, investments, etc. So everything was booming. And there were McDonald's and Shells and Nestle and many, many of these big names. And I applied to all of them, and they all rejected me. They said no. So I was totally crushed. I was like, that's it. No, my dreams are ruined. I'm never going to be able to travel. And I remember very clearly how I was thinking that, and I was thinking, well, no matter what, I have to work. I don't have any other money. I cannot support myself. And I was looking through ads in a newspaper, and I said, okay, I studied banking, so let me at least, maybe they will accept me. And the first ad I had of a local Bulgarian bank, they accepted me. And this is how it started. Well, I had to swallow back my dreams and say, okay, it's a Bulgarian bank, right? No chance I'm going to travel. But the thing is, I have to do the best that I can. And I started
learning. You got to start somewhere, right?
Yeah, I have to start somewhere. And I was like a sponge. Whatever they wanted to give me, I was there ready, studying banking from really the bottom of the ladder, really bottom in the operations department, making payments with SWIFT to Telex and stuff. Telex, people have forgotten what Telex is. So that's how my banking career started, completely by chance. And after that, it was very intentional. Because I said, okay, I'm here. I better learn as much as possible about banking. And if possible, I want to travel with banking, with banks.
So can you give us an example for our listeners? When you say that you're very intentional in how you went about doing it, can you give us a story, an example of what that looked like?
I had the idea that I didn't think I would become a C-suite executive or CEO or anything like this, but I just knew that I want to be at the top. I want to reach the top. And in my mind at that time, without any knowledge whatsoever, I thought that to reach the top, you have to know about every single department in a bank, because if you have to manage something, you should know everything, right? You should be in different parts of the bank, because when you're on the top, there are so many issues coming from everywhere. So you should be able to understand how the bank works and how everything works. So that's why I started in operations. Then I moved to customer service. Then I was working in branch network. I went to every part of operations again. I was HR. I was branch network, opening branches from the ground up, hiring, transactional services, risk, audit, I mean, everything apart from investment banking. I've done product management, I've done relationship management, I've done sales. Yeah. So
you've done all of it. You've done all of it. And what I'd like to say, you know, for our listeners out there, you know, Annie and I have completely different worlds. I mean, I think you and I spoke, and at one time you were overseeing 20,000 people. In my situation at LearnIt, you know, much, you know, small business. But what you were saying, which I could really relate to, is I did every aspect from receptionist to teaching to sales. And I think what helps with that, when you become a leader and you're able to have the empathy and understanding what other people do, you can relate better with them. And they also can't pull a curtain over your eyes either, because you kind of understand how things could work and things didn't work. How were you able to go from department to department to department? Were you proactive in asking for those opportunities? Because it doesn't sound like you were, you know, you sat still and people just came to you with things. I'd assume you were proactive in saying, hey, I want to do this. I want to do that.
Yeah. I was always looking for the next thing. And that's very much in line with my temperament. So I just can't. I like change. I like change. Many people don't like it. I just like it. I can't stand to be in one place and doing only one thing all my life. And that's pretty different than most of the people who build careers, because they just say, okay, I'm going to build in this vertical. And they go step by step by step by step, far faster than me, building that. But for me, that was absolutely no. For me, that was not a future or any kind of no appeal whatsoever. And I was just looking for, I mean, when I was in operations, I learned everything, I mean, that there was. And I said, okay, now, what is the next step? So from operations with what I know, where can I go? And customer service is the first one, right? Because you're linking basically all the customers' problems are operational problems, most of them, right? Something didn't go, the payment was late, the value date was wrong, you know, it was stopped. So I knew how to deal with that. And then from customer service, it's very easy to move to another department. Use whatever you've learned and see how you can, for instance, go to front office or go to branch network. So there is always some kind of a overlap that I was pursuing. So what is the overlap with where I want to be? And yes, it's all proactive. I mean, if I was just sitting there waiting for things to happen, I would still be in that Bulgarian bank, I think.
So what I hear you saying, and you know, we're going to eventually get to your new career, but you're somebody who's comfortable with change, and that's a very tough thing for a lot of people. And it part of it sounds like you're just a very curious person, and you're also not really afraid of failure, because you just want to go for it. What advice or practical tips do you have for our listeners who are listening out there and they're saying, you know what? I'd love to do what Annie does. I just don't have the courage to stick my neck out there and try to do it.
Yeah, first of all, I just want to say that I was afraid and I was uncomfortable and I was anxious all the time. That when I say that I like change, that doesn't mean that I breeze in and out and I have no issue. No, I'm just, I had days when I don't sleep and I don't eat. I'm so stressed and I just, but for some reason, I just keep going because if I didn't keep going, I couldn't live with the consequences of that. So if, for instance, I have to, let's say, move countries and I move from one job to another, and it's tough. You have to move everything. You start again in a new country with new people. Everything is new. The climate is new. The customs are new. Everything is new. But even if it is you're moving from one department to another, new people, new requirements, new boss, everything new. So you know something. You know like 30%, but you have to learn 70. And the thing is, if you are afraid, but if you stop and say, no, I cannot do that, so what are you going to do? You're going to be stuck in that place because you're afraid, right? And so are you going to be more happy? No, you're not going to be. And that for me was really the push, that I don't want to stay there. I have to move ahead. And after the first several moves, I knew that I will do it. I will find a way. I'll find a way. And if it doesn't work, well, then I will find something else that will work. So it's always, everything is to do with how you talk to yourself and how do you stop yourself? Because when we are in a situation where we are afraid or we don't know what is going to happen, we start imagining some stuff and that creates even more fear and you're more anxious, etc. So what I always do is I stop and I say, okay, so what are these fears? Why do I think that? And then I realize that majority of this is like I'm imagining it, right? I'm just thinking, oh, now they will see that I don't understand, and they will say, oh, she's not good. And then I say to myself, yeah, but they interviewed me and they hired me, right? So they know better. And I'll give it a go. And there is a training program. And I'm a new person. I'll ask a lot of questions. So that's basically, there is no rocket science behind it. You just have to stop these negative thoughts that you have. And consciously, you just stop and say, okay, nobody's going to die. Nothing wrong is going to happen with you. It's just that it's something new. That's why I like this. And then I would say to myself, yeah, you do it. I'll do it. And this somehow just calms me down until the next day. And I'm again in actions. And then I again calm down. So that process of talking to yourself and really understanding what is going on and why are you anxious and discovering what is the truth in that and why and what is the imaginary, that's very, very important.
I think it's so important because I agree with you 100%. I think we always blow things out of proportion and we take them to the worst case scenario. And you know who taught me that? My mom. My mom said, why waste your time worrying about the worst possible scenario? Because she said, Damon, think back about how often did that actually even happen? Very rare. So don't worry about that. Have positive thoughts, positive energy, and put it in the right place. Because at the end of the day, if you're too scared to try something, then you're left your whole life wondering, could I have done this or not? At least if you try and you fail, you can at least tell yourself, hey, you know what? I tried. But for our listeners out there, I love what Annie's saying, and it's so true. Like, it almost gave me goosebumps a little bit. It's like, try. Just go out and do it. Because the worst case scenario is never really, most likely not going to happen. And at the end of the day, you're not going to die from it. I mean, we're talking about corporate work here. I'm not telling you to climb a mountain, fall off a mountain. I'm talking about our career here. So you get to become COO of Citibank. Did you ever imagine you go from this little girl in a socialist country to COO of one of the largest financial institutions in the world? So what was your first day like when you got to your highest level at Citibank?
My first day, I was so scared and I was so... I was almost frozen because I was getting this job. I've never been a CEO before. I had no clue what am I doing. And I remember clearly I came in the office. Everything was set up for me, the computer, the office. There was this amazing lady who was my assistant. And everybody look at you and say, oh, they're curious, oh, who is she, what is she? And then I, because we had a very big floor in Citibank for our products, because I was the CEO of Food Treasury and Trade Solution, which
in
is
where?
One of the...
Where were
in
at?
Citibank, in Hong Kong,
in
which
Hong
is
Kong.
Original.
That's what I meant. Yeah.
Yeah, I was based in Hong Kong, and we were on the 60th floor of a building with an amazing view. Windows all around and open floor apart from the offices of the of all the executive committee members. And I remember going and I said to myself, well, today there is not going to be anything else. I'm just going to go and introduce myself. So, and I always find that talking to people calms me down. And I said, okay, I'm going to go and introduce myself. And by the end of walking the floor, I felt much better. Not in the second day, I was not in the same state, worried and frightened and, you know, scared, anxious. What is going to happen? What are they going to think? What am I going to do and stuff? But yeah, that was my first day. I will never forget it because you are so, you have this job. And you come to this country, to Hong Kong, and it's amazing. And you get in the office, and it's an amazing view. And you're going in the office, and you're saying, my goodness, I'm the CEO of this business. So, and the elation of the days before that, when you're just, oh, wow, oh, I'm the first day, it's like you go rock bottom. You just fall on the bottom, and you just realize that you know nothing, nothing that will help you. But that, of course, is not true. As I said, you talk to yourself, you don't know anything. You've never been a CEO. These people have been in this business for years. You are the newcomer. You come from risk. You come, and all this creates this. So people think it's all. Because on the outside, I obviously lose confidence and everything. But on the inside, I'm just like, everything is like this.
So when you get to, so first of all, you wake up like, I can't believe this is me. This is, you know, I mean, here I am. And you're excited, but you're nervous and all this. But you're also in a completely new culture. Were you in Hong Kong for a while? So not only are you in a new position, but, and you're coming to work with people who probably have a lot more experience or have been around a lot longer, but then there's this whole new culture that has to go along with it as well. How are you able to absorb all of that?
I never had any problems with different cultures because I'm open to any. Actually, living in Hong Kong is, getting accustomed to living in Hong Kong is extremely easy. It's an amazing place to live. The only fear we had, which was totally in our heads, is that we came from Singapore, where Singapore is not that densely populated. It's a little bit bigger. It's such a small place, but still not as dense as Hong Kong. And on the first day, you go on the street in Hong Kong, and there's so many people that you just feel threatened, but you're not threatened at all, and it was on the second day of arriving in Hong Kong. What happened is we went in a service apartment, and under the service apartment there was a big mall, and we went to shop with the two kids. Our kids were 5 years old. We have twins. Yes, and I left my husband with my son, and I went with my daughter somewhere, and we said we'll meet in the apartment. And for that, like 15, 20 minutes of time, my husband managed to lose my son.
Oh, no.
My son decided to go find me.
And your kid was five?
Yeah, he was five. And he wandered away.
I'm sure you weren't happy with your husband.
My husband was absolutely, I mean, I could, when I went home after they found each other and they were waiting for us home, I could see my husband was still, you know, trembling. But they announced our son name on the lost kid, yeah. Come and collect the lost kid. And because he's Caucasian and there were not so many Caucasians, it was like everybody was so, so happy. And that's the thing, the people there are so helpful and so, it is so safe. It's one of the safest places on earth. And so it was, we just started living in Hong Kong without any issues. It was easy for us.
Okay. So we have a lot of senior leaders who listen to our podcast here, and they say, they might be thinking to themselves, okay, well, this is easy for her to navigate the cultural changes and cultural differences, because it's not just Hong Kong. You've been over several countries. What practical advice or tips do you have somebody who's maybe taking a job abroad or going somewhere else, and they're going to have to learn how to navigate cultures? Because I have a good friend who used to work here, and she managed teams across France, Italy, and in other parts of the world. And she's like, Damon, it is completely different. You have to do things much differently. What advice do you have somebody like that, who I'm thinking about, who's jumping into a role like this?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think the very important is to do what I normally do. What I normally do is I talk to somebody in the office, because when you know where you're going, there are a lot of preparations. You're connected with somebody from HR who will help you with the transition. So you start asking questions. So what is the culture? I mean, how do you show people that you appreciate them? What do you shake hands? How do you approach them? I mean, are they, do you have to, what is the common thing? What is the practice or the market? How do people greet each other? What is considered bad? What is considered rude? Because you don't know, right? So these are very important things. What is considered rude? Because you might do something that is rude for people, but you don't know because it's not rude for you.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So this, these are the first things I would do. And then this is even before I have arrived in the country, right? So I would talk to as many people as possible just to understand their experience. And I would try and talk to different nationalities because different nationalities see the world in a different way because they were raised up in a different way. So that's the goal. Get as many diverse feedback you can. And then the first, when you arrive, go by the rules and start making connections with people, start talking to people. And then it's very important to talk to colleagues of what is appropriate and what is, because some of the Asian, in Asia, people are a bit more shy. There is no such culture of speaking up and being loud, etc. So you have to learn how to deal with that and to know that if nobody speaks in the meeting, you have to probably do something else, ask them for an opinion or ask them to write an opinion for you because they might not be okay to speak. You just have to learn the first month of being somewhere, you have to really learn, absorb, ask questions, not only about the business, but also about how things are done. What is the right way to work with people?
I think that's great because what I see a lot of times with people, sometimes people I coach or mentor, they move into these new companies or they get promoted into different positions or different areas, and they immediately think it's their responsibility to change everything right off the bat. And I tell them that's the wrong way to go. What you sounds like you're doing, Annie, again, is you're starting off and you're making connections. You're going around, you're talking to people. You want to understand what's maybe working well, kind of get them on your side instead of being that new boss who comes in who just says, we're going to do it my way. Or like I call them the know-it-all bosses, right? And so you're, again, just being curious. Can you dig a little deeper on that? Because I think that is so important. And I want to emphasize this to our listeners because that's a big mistake. And a lot of times when you do that, you never gain the trust and the motivation of the people you're leading if you just go in and push everything aside.
Yeah, absolutely. And first of all, when you go in, you know nothing about the place. Yeah, you know the numbers and you know what are the products and how it is doing, etc. But you don't know the internal politics, shall I call it, or internal relationships and balance and who works with whom, etc. Who is perceived how. And the first month, that's always what I do. I just go deeper into and only listen, because in order to change anything, you first of all have to see, is there a problem? What is the problem? Who says this is a problem? And if you have to change, what is the goal, right? It's not for the sake of change. You don't need to prove yourself the first week. I think you can prove yourself by helping rather than saying, oh, you have to change. No, help them. Help. I think that the thing that always works with me, and many people have said that, is that I'm trying to find the connection between, it's like a universe and this is you and there are different departments. So what are these departments doing? What is the input and output? Who are the other people that you depend on? And what are the people that are dependent on you? And by knowing these connections in interconnections, you start building a picture. And by the end of the second month, your goal should be, you know, they say 30, 60, 90 days in a new job. By the end of the second month, you should have an idea of how is this place run, what can potentially be an issue, and then make some kind of a plan or suggestion or, you know, to your boss and to the executive committee and see, throw some ideas and see how they are perceived. Because going aggressively and arrogantly is not going to help at all. Yeah, you might do some changes, but that's not guaranteed. This will be the changes that need to be done.
So that leads me to my next question. So let's say you're 2 months into it, right? And you see that there's some specific changes that you really think need to be made. And for the first 60 days, you're kind of sitting on your hands, for lack of a better term, because you don't want to jump in and make the changes, but you see that these need to be made. You go to your boss. Have you ever gone to your boss, you present them, and they say, no, that we're not gonna, that's not gonna happen. So how did you handle that situation? And maybe share the story if you can.
I've never had like a outright no. It's always, not yet, not now. And how do I handle this situation? Well, you have to find a way through it. And if there is, maybe you didn't give enough ammunition, enough data, enough information that shows that this has to change, right? Then you can go and collect more, or you continue to observe the situation, because if you think something is wrong and needs to change, then obviously if they say no, that doesn't mean that that should go off your radar. No, you just continue monitoring it, and then every so often raise it in a conversation and say, by the way, that continues to persist, etc. It's good to be, if you have really something that is a real concern, you have to raise it potentially at a meeting. So it's documented somewhere that that was discussed. In the corporate world, that's very important. But you have to do it in a way that doesn't set people off, because then there will be unnecessary pushback.
Yeah, you can't be childish. You can't be childish with it. You know, yeah, I mean, we've all had situations where you think you have a great idea, you come and either you're told no or maybe not now. And I think it's really the way you handle it. And sometimes you have to self-reflect yourself. Well, maybe I didn't do a good enough job presenting it. Maybe I didn't create enough sense of urgency. So instead of playing the victim or saying, oh, I put in so much hard work with this, blah, 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 feel sorry for me. You know, it's like, look in the mirror. Maybe there's something you could do differently. And you just got to get on board, because that's, you know, because there's a lot of people looking at you as their leader to see how they should be responding to things like that too. And just keep coming back to the table.
Yeah. And being childish about it, that didn't even cross my mind. I mean, that's not a behavior that a senior leader should have, right? And being a victim. I mean, just, this is something that, I mean, when you said it, I realized this didn't even cross my mind. So that's basically how a leader should be, you know? There is no such thing. I mean, childish. You're sitting there and you're responsible for people, you're responsible for operations, for processes, for revenue. You can't just be a victim. If you're a victim, imagine what is going to happen with the people that report to you. That will have an impact on the culture, etc. So it's always, as a senior leader, you have to lead by example. So if you want people to be honest, transparent, share with you what the real issue is, you have to be that. So you have to be open, transparent, and share what the real issue is. There is always a way to share even the most negative news. You cannot hide it.
You cannot hide it.
You cannot hide it. Because it will come out and it come and it will come out from a, another source, and that is going to hurt the whole. The
people
whole
won't trust
department.
You. They're not gonna. They're not gonna trust you.
You lose trust like this. It's just gone, and you could have sat there and said it in a way that people would understand it. You always find a way to do that. So that's what I learned from my my boss, who was the CEO of, he was the most open and transparent boss I've ever had.
And probably humble too.
Yeah, very humble. And you always knew where are you with him. You always knew. You didn't need to guess. And this is one of the most important things that I always advise people to be. Because when you're at senior position, people think, oh, I cannot be vulnerable. I cannot be open because others are going to use it against me. But it's not true. You can be open and vulnerable, and that's enough for the other people. They can do whatever. I mean, they can speak, they can blame you, point fingers. But if you continue to be open, call their lies in a very professional manner, that's what you have to do. You just can't. Behaviors like victim or egotistic or you're not there for yourself. You're there for the team.
You're there for your team.
The team has to succeed.
And here's for all our listeners out here. The reason why Annie got to where she got is because of what she's talking about, because she's not a victim, because she is transparent and she's accountable. Because I see so many people out there that, you know, come to me who want to be promoted, or they think they should be promoted, and all they do is blame somebody else, blame other people. That's why you're stuck at the level you are, because you're not owning up to things. And it takes a special type of talent that we all can do, right? We all have it in us. But Annie, that's why you've gotten to where you're at, which is incredible. At the high point, didn't you tell me that you had about 20,000 people underneath you?
No, it was the region is 10,000.
Okay, well, I was close.
But you know, that doesn't matter that much, because you don't get to manage all these people,
right?
You see your immediate reports and the other executive members of the executive committee, and everybody has their own rundowns, etc. So when you say it's 10,000, people might think, oh gosh, how this is done, and it's done like everything else. You have a team, and this team works with their team, and their team works with their team. And that's why it's so important that you are open, transparent, decent, taking decisions fast, trying to get people in instead of dividing them, because dividing conquer is the worst approach you can have. And the one thing that really helped me in my career, especially when I was a COO, was the fact that I was in operations, I was in risk, I was in the business side, product relationship. I was heading departments in my past. So I knew both sides of the, so I knew what sales want and I knew what operations want. And I knew that sales look down on operations and operations think, oh, sales look down on us. So I would always knew how, what would they think, what this party would think, and this is how I would calibrate my approach. And
do you
that's
have any
why,
specific stories? Or could you give like anything top of mind? Because I know exactly what you're saying, because I've lived it and I've seen it. But maybe for our listeners out there, anything we could connect the dots with a story on that?
Okay. So when I joined Treasury and Trade Solutions as a CEO, it was the moment when the bank started changing because of the fintech companies which were taking parts and developing better solutions for customers than us. So the years I spent in at that position were all about change, new products, digitization, etc. And we had to organize this, we had to have this new process of how we release products. We had everybody at the table.
Operations, sales,
compliance,
product.
Legal, absolutely everybody. And it was because people knew that I know both sides. It was interesting that operations saw in me somebody who would take their interest at heart too. And that made all the difference, because it's so often when the business side like front office, product, etc., they do something and I say, okay, operations, just do it.
Yeah.
And I throw it over the
Yeah,
over
it's like
the
throwing a hand grenade over the fence, right?
And I don't care what
operations
happens.
Operations,
right?
Figure it out. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And poor operations have workaround and this and that, and they make mistakes, and then everybody blames them.
Yeah.
And I know it's awful because it doesn't work this way. So I was stopping this, and that's why the forum was created this way. So we can have everybody around the table, and it depends on everybody. So this is how people started working together. Because, you know, when you say, okay, every product will be released, every new product will be released only if everybody here sign, there is no going back, right? You can't throw it because it's all open in that meeting. And everybody knows what is going on. I know because I was chairing it. So that's how basically it happened. You just have to invite everybody at the table, but also make sure that everybody treats everyone with the same respect. So they have equal rights. Equal responsibilities. That's it. Nobody is more or less. Everybody is the same. Because the end of the day, for the client, doesn't care, right? Is it operations, legal, treasury, compliance? No, the client wants a product that works. And every part, everybody has a job. Legal has to tell us that we don't have any legal issues. Compliance, that we are not breaking any rules. Sales, that the sales process is good. The education department is that the training for this product is done. So everybody plays a role, and that had to be understood.
So important. I just can't emphasize that enough, that it's not just sales, it's not just product. A company, an organization, a team that's going to be successful is everybody realizes that they all play an important role, and they all could work together. And that's the leader's responsibility. I see a lot of leaders who jump on the sales side, right? Because they're like, you know, they'll take the sales side all the time. But you come in with somebody like you, and operations feel like, oh, Annie has my back, you know, product has my back, you know, we're important. And also that you've listened to them, that you've heard them, that you give them an opportunity to speak, that you're not sitting in this meeting and you have one loudmouth who's taking everything over, you know, everybody gets an opportunity to speak. I think people come to work more motivated for that.
I have to say that every single senior executive who I know who is good has always been always understood the fact that every part in the equation is important, right? And they were equally good. They understood risk. They understood the issues that can come to us, compliance. So they put equal importance to everybody in the room.
I think that's great. I want to get to your this change that you made. But one last question I have around your time at Citibank is, if I sat around a table with six people who worked for you for a while, what would they say about you as a leader?
That's an interesting question. what would they say? They would say that that I would always try and find a solution, and I would always try and find consensus. That's what people would say. I mean, that would come in my appraisal, that I am solution consensus finder. consensus seeker and finder. That's something that I'm kind. I listen to people. I empathize, and I'm open and transparent. I think this is what they say. I'm confident this is what they say.
And I hope our listeners rewind 2 minutes and write that all down and think about themselves in that light to see if, am I kind? Am I looking for consensus? You know, am I open-minded? Am I curious? All the things that you just said. What was the biggest accomplishment at Citibank while you were there? That it was related to you, to your team.
Look, the thing is that at that time, as a CEO, you're just overarching, right? Your team is the business, right? So the biggest achievement for all of us was that we won Best Digital Bank in Asia for 7 consecutive years. And I believe after that, they won this too. After I left, continuously had this award. And we were every second year, we were the best transactional bank, Euromoney, best transactional bank. So this a big, for me, this a big achievement.
That's incredible. Congratulations for being a part of a team that was able to do that. So 2021 comes around, and did you just wake up one day and say, hey, you know what? I'm just going to give up this career as COO and start my own thing. How can you share with me a little bit of how did that come about?
Well, it was like one day I woke up, but it was not in 2021. It was in 2019 when my kids became 9 years old. And I remember sitting at their birthday. And before I continue, I'll just say that when I had my kids, and I had my kids, I was almost 40. I was 39. I was 1 month shy of 40. And at that time, I said I had 6 months pregnancy maternity leave, which was the best time of my life. I thought to myself, okay, I want to find this time when I'm going to spend more time with my kids. Because in our family, I was the working corporate, etc. My husband was working from home. He was doing investment. He was earning money more than me, even. But he was at home, so he got to see our kids more than me. So that was always bothering me that I don't spend enough time. And I was always saying, okay, I have to. I mean, one day, I have to do that. And this one day came on their ninth birthday, and I was thinking again. I was thinking on one day, and I was thinking, okay, they're 9, so there'll be 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and that's it, right? They'll be not interested in me at all. And if I have this window of opportunity from now to 18 to basically connect with them, and if I continue to work this work, I will never be able to have enough time, never. And this is when I said, okay, I have to do something about it, because remember I told you my thing is, can I live with the consequences? If there is an issue, can I live with it? And I couldn't live with these consequences. I couldn't live with them because my kids will never be 9 again. My kids will be only once 10 again, 10. They'll never be 10 again. So this time passes and they will never, never come back. While I can have another career, I can have something else. And I can reinvent myself, right? But time with your kids when they're small, you will never get back. So I said, I can't live with losing more years like this. And from there on, we had to plan with my husband. And to be honest, the technical part of everything, where we're going to live, finances, do we have enough, planning everything, the Excel spreadsheet and income expenses. That was the easy part. The difficult part was, how am I going to perceive myself? How am I going to survive in this world without the title of a COO, right? and without this name of Citibank behind me, because it's a huge name. You know, every when you say, "Oh, I work with Citibank," even without saying CEO, you're already somebody, right? While you say Anna Filipova, who is this bird, right? Nobody knows. And then this was what I was thinking in the beginning. And then slowly, day after day, completely intentionally, I was doing tests and trying to test myself, my conviction of leaving. Because I just wanted to make sure that I don't leave. And then in 3 months, I said, oh, no, that was the worst thing I did in my life. I have to go back. So I just wanted to be at least 80% sure that that's not going to happen. So that was the toughest part. But slowly when you think about it and again, it's like you start run. I was running through my issues. The things that I was thinking probably are not good and I will be ashamed or I would not have the right status, etc. And I would always go back to the main thing. Okay, so if I stay and have the status, how is that helping me being with my kids? It doesn't. Okay, so then that worry has to go. But then it comes back again and you calm down and in several days you go to a meeting or something and people meet you and you say, okay, see how they meet me. And if I'm not in city, that's not going to happen. And again, this internal fight and worry starts. Oh, am I making the right thing? And then back to basics. Why am I doing this? Because I want to have more time.
What's the purpose? More time to kids.
Yeah, exactly. And I kept going back to that nonstop. And in the next 6 months, I was like, yeah, we're doing that. That's it. I'm going, whatever happens, I'm happy. I will survive. I will go through. And that's how it happened.
So what I take from that is, first of all, it's really important to me personally because I got a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old, like I mentioned to you. And it's good to just remember that they're not always going to be this age. So I don't want to lose out on the time. As much as I love doing my work, you know, Wally at 3 years old, I'm never going to get that back. There's an old American song called Cats in the Cradle. I don't know if you ever heard about that, where the whole part of the beginning of the song is the kid always wants to be with the dad and the dad's just too busy. And then 20 years, the kid's like, hey dad, let's play catch. Let's do this. And he's like, sorry, kid, I got to go to work. I got to travel. I got to do this. Then the kid comes home from college and the dad now retired and wants to spend time with the kid and the kid doesn't have time with him. And the dad realized that he gave up all those years that he shouldn't have. He should have been more involved from the beginning. And so that's just a great story of a purpose you bring to it. And the other thing, Annie, I like about that story, I like to call purposeful awfulizing, is that you didn't just jump to it. You did testing, but what you did is you also looked at, like, what's the worst case scenario? You know, fast forward a year or so, and is this something that I could live with? You know, is this something financially or that I want to do? And I think a lot of time people make that mistake. They just jump to things before realizing, before really calculating whether or not how that would affect them or not. So I think that that's amazing. And so now you're doing your own thing. Can you share a little bit about how you're helping either organizations or individuals?
Yeah. So I have a portfolio career, as I like to call it, which is a collation of initiatives and projects that I do. I don't have a full-time job, but I have several different jobs. So first of all, I'm a career coach. I help C-suite executives and, mid-career executives. So for C-suite, it's mostly about how can they do what I did? How can they live the corporate life? What do they need to prepare? For the mid-career, I do the same, but also some people come to me to help them with career progression, change, what job to take, what are the new trends, how they have to, how to prepare, what to know, how to get promoted, etc. I also just open a community, which is a paid community, where we are going to have monthly meetings. There will be Q&A session with me.
What's the name
Change is Possible. Change is Possible. I'll send you the link so you can put it in. So it's Change is Possible, just like my podcast. So the community is, again, for people who want to develop their leadership, learn how to build a personal brand, learn how to build a portfolio career, how to create a side interest while they work, while still working. And they will have the opportunity to have a Q&A with me every month. I'll sit 1 hour and answer any question they have. So that's the second one. Third, I work with an American university, Northern Illinois, from Chicago. And we offer executive MBA and courses on topics like change, organizational behavior, AI, for Eastern Europe, Bulgaria, Greece, Turkey. So my podcast is called Change is Possible. And I started it after I left the corporate life because I wanted to show people that change is really possible and everybody can take a different job, a different life if they focus on that and they have a plan. And I interview individuals who've professionals, entrepreneurs from the corporate life who have done significant change in their careers. I also speak at conferences. I write daily on LinkedIn about leadership, change, career, future of work. So that's me. That's what I do now.
So our listeners, we know where to connect with Annie at. But before we wrap it up, do you have any other advice you'd like to share with our audience?
Any other advice? Yeah. I want to say that that people should have dreams and they should have goals. And they should not listen to others who say, no, you cannot do that, or it's too late, you're too old. There is no such opportunity. The market is saturated. They should not listen to that. I'm not saying jump straight in the deep. Make your research and then take a decision. But don't just make excuses, because life is too short. It's only one life. There is no sequel. There's no episode 2, 3, or 4. It's just only one. So don't be afraid to take decisions that seem very big and very, very dangerous because they're not. When you look back, you will see that you did the right thing. It's always like this. Anyone who is listening, think about your past and think, how many of these decisions that you said, oh, they were for wrong, they were not good decisions. No matter what you decide, you'll see later on that it was for good and it was meant to happen. And you can only see that by looking back. That's why it's so important to self-reflect very, very often and tap yourself on the back of what you have achieved.
Annie, I have to say, this has been one of my favorite interviews. It really has been. And we covered so much today. We talked about growing up in a socialist country to getting out of your comfort zone and traveling and your joy of traveling and jumping head into things and trying them and realizing, hey, what do you really have to lose? Not being a victim, the importance of when you take a new job or leading a new team to not try to change things right away. Listen, get curious, spend the first 60 days getting to know your team, getting to know your culture, and also not being afraid to make a bold move. Take chances. Don't be a victim. Go out there and see what happens and give yourself a pat on the back. Do some self-reflection. And there's only one life, you know, no episode 2, 3, and 4, maybe different phases, and you could do different things. So what I want to say, well, first of all, I have to say this. I got to say thank you to our mutual friend, Omar. Omar Holibab, right? Is that how you say
it?
Yeah. I love Omar. He's the best for connecting us. And like Omar, Annie's got a great following on LinkedIn. She produces great content out there. So make sure we follow her on LinkedIn. Check out her podcast. That will be in the notes. Sign up for her community. Send her a message. This has been a wonderful time. And for all our listeners out there today, if you know anybody who, for instance, maybe has more talent than they give themselves credit for and are afraid to try things, do me a favor. Take this episode on whatever platform you're on and text it to them and say, check out Annie's story. If Annie can go from Bulgaria to running a team with 10,000 people to transitioning to running her own business so she could spend more time with her kids, so can you. So thank you, Annie. And tell everybody, until next time, stay curious, keep learning, and talk to you soon. See ya.
Thank you so much. Bye.